It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. As the United Nations Climate Conference in Dubai, COP28, comes to a close, we examine the settlements as world leaders hash out the future of oil, gas, coal, and renewable energy. Call in with a question or comments. The number to join in is 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Samudu Atupatu is director of the Global Legal Studies Center and a teaching professor at UW-Madison, teaching international environmental law and at COP28. Samudu, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Thank you so much.
Well, let's start as you are there wrapping up today, the end of COP28. You've been to previous UN climate change conferences. Did this one feel more urgent to you?
Yes, and it is also the biggest. So we have people from all over the world, from all walks of life, at different levels. I saw that over 100,000 people had registered for the conference. So the urgency is there, and the crowds, that was amazing to see. And there were lots of youth representatives, which I was very glad to see.
What is the message that you hear from youth as they attend COP28? What are they trying to convey to world leaders?
They are saying it's their future. Their future is not for negotiation. I heard that today and yesterday. And they're saying, you know, don't jeopardize our future.
Don't jeopardize our future. Now, there is contention at the conference as countries, dozens of countries, push for a timeline to eliminate fossil fuels. But we're hearing how oil-producing countries oppose the language that was dropped yesterday from a draft resolution. You know, what is the situation as diplomats have been working overnight to draft a new final agreement? What can you tell us there?
Everybody is waiting. The whole day we have been waiting to see the new draft. We saw that it will come out in a couple of hours, maybe. We are not sure. So everybody is waiting to see how the new language will shape up and what will happen after that. Because as you pointed out, the world's phasing out fossil fuels. The words were taken out. So reducing consumption and production has been included. And I must point out that this is the first time that there's even a reference to fossil fuels. So from that point of view, it's a step forward. But a lot of people, activists and youth wanted phasing out included in the draft. So unfortunately, that's not there yet, but we are hopeful that something more productive will be included in the draft, but everybody is waiting right now.
Samudu, how does precise language matter in this moment? You mentioned words like phase out versus phase down of fossil fuels. What is in the language?
Words are important, right? Mm. Particularly for lawyers, words are really important. But I must point out that the document itself is not a treaty. It's a decision of a conference of parties. But it's also useful in the hands of, you know, NGOs, activists, and policymakers, you know, and voters, I should say. We can hold our policymakers accountable for living up to the words that they accepted at this conference. So I think that commitment to the phasing out of fossil fuels, which caused the problem in the first place, is important.
Samudu Atupatu is director of the Global Legal Studies Center, a teaching professor at the University of Wisconsin Law School, joining us from Dubai, where the UN Conference on Climate Change is set to wrap up. You can join in questions and comments along the way, 800-642-1234. Samudu, the conference pledged to commit $83 billion for various efforts to fight climate change. Do you think our activists happy with this amount? Are they pleased?
No. Mm-hmm. I just came out of a press conference that was basically about U.S. obligations. And they were saying, throughout the day, they have been saying this is not enough. In order to transition to carbon neutral economy, we need trillions of dollars, and this is just nothing compared to what's actually needed. Plus, we have small island states that are facing a very bleak future. The loss and damage mechanism that was a step forward at this COP meeting requires, again, trillions of dollars. And the pledges, which are welcome, of course, are unfortunately not enough. We really need to ratchet up the commitments that states have made. It's a good step forward, but it's not enough.
Trillions of dollars. And you mentioned the loss and damage fund, and you've advocated for richer nations to help developing countries adapt to climate change. Can you talk a little bit about what this fund will enable?
Sure. So there are losses that will be irreparable. So like moving some people from, these small island states, from low-lying areas, so that, their lives won't be in danger. People are already moving, but we might have to even move countries. These small island states, as I said, with sea level rise and other severe weather events, are facing a very bleak future. They are the ground zero of climate change. So this loss and damage mechanism, which they have been advocating for since the 1990s, finally became reality at this COP. But as I said, the funding is not enough for irreparable damage as well as damage that they are facing to adapt to the consequences. So we need lots of funding, lots of assistance, resources to these communities that contributed very little to the problem. That there's a huge injustice here. Their contribution to climate change is like 1% as compared to developed countries who basically created the problem.
I want to ask you about the path forward for renewable energy and the implications here in Wisconsin, because leaders from 120 countries pledged to triple the world's renewable energy capacity by 2030. What impact could this expansion have on Wisconsin?
Every state in the U.S. will have to transition to renewable energy sooner than later. And the scientists are pointing out that the consequences are happening faster. The adverse consequences of climate change are happening faster than they predicted. So we had to go carbon neutral before 2050, which was the earlier target. So every state, including Wisconsin, will have to produce more renewable sources of energy, go for more renewable sources, and, reduce our consumption.
Samudu, I want to take a quick call here. Kevin in Janesville, go ahead.
Good morning. I am a sixth grade math and science teacher, and we are currently studying global climate change. What do my sixth graders need to be learning right now? Thank you.
Thank you, Kevin. Samuda, go ahead.
Sure. There are lots of things that we can do as individuals, reducing our consumption of energy, going for switching to low energy consumption or, these new light bulbs even, reducing our plastic, reducing food waste. Food waste is a big issue that's contributing to climate change. Driving less. If we can use public transportation, do that. Because I know in some areas we cannot, but try and walk more, try and cycle more. So that as individuals, there's a lot we can do. And then, changing our diet will help too. Going to a more plant-based diet will help as well.
So there are individuals, a lot of things that even sixth graders can do in their own lives to lead a healthier future for the planet. Oh, Samuda, thank you so much for joining us from Dubai.
Thank you for having me.
Samuda Attupattu is director of the Global Legal Studies Center, a teaching professor at the University of Wisconsin Law School, teaching international environmental law with a focus on climate change and human rights. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Devices known as baby boxes are now legal in Wisconsin with the goal of anonymously and safely handing over an unwanted newborn. We learn about the new development to expand our state's safe haven program, and you can be part of the conversation. Call in with a question, add comments at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Monica Kelsey is founder and CEO of the nonprofit organization Safe Haven Baby Boxes. Monica, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Oh, thanks for having me, guys.
So Wisconsin Governor Tony Evers, our governor, has signed into law this measure allowing the use of baby boxes in hospitals, at fire stations, law enforcement buildings. Why should emergency facilities consider installing these boxes?
Well, you know, the Safe Haven Baby Box is just an extension of the already existing Safe Haven law that's been around for the last 22 years, where a parent can walk in and hand their child to a worker there and turn around and walk away, no questions asked. You know, with the changing culture, we have to advance this law. And unfortunately, anonymity matters to some women where they don't want to walk in and they don't want to hand you a child. They don't want to look you in the eye. They don't want to answer any of your questions. And so instead of finding babies consistently in dumpsters and trash cans, now we're finding babies in our boxes in the states that have them. And so we're trying to turn the tide so that babies aren't left out to die. And in Wisconsin's, you know, had a rash of abandonments in the last 2 years. And so we're going to try and combat that with the use of baby boxes and allowing women 100% anonymity in the state of Wisconsin now.
Why, I wonder, could a face-to-face interaction be a challenge, be a barrier in this time of crisis for the person who has had a baby?
Well, you know, different women have different crises. Every surrender is different. Mm-hmm. I spoke with a woman one time that actually surrendered in one of our boxes, and I asked her why she didn't walk in and hand the child to a person. And she's now a volunteer for our organization. But she said that she didn't want the firefighters talking her out of a decision that took her so long to make. Mm-hmm. And that really struck me. Because as a firefighter and a medic, which I retired in 2019, I mean, we're fixers, we're helpers. We want to help. And so the first thing that we would do is, hey, hang on a second. Let's talk about this. What can we do to help you? And these women don't want that. They just want to be done. And so with the use of baby boxes, allowing the anonymity piece, we're saving the lives of children that possibly could have been thrown in dumpsters and trash cans.
Can you explain the process of how this box works? A person pulls a drawer to access this temperature-controlled hospital bassinet. What happens to the newborn after they're placed in a baby box?
So we basically cut a hole in the side of like a fire station where you're like putting a window in, and the box actually slides into the firehouse. And so the outside of the baby box is on the outside, and the inside is on the inside where the baby's going to be pulled. And basically mom just walks up to the baby box, opens the door. She doesn't have to do anything except open the door, and an immediate 911 call goes out. It's automatic. She doesn't have to touch anything or push anything. And then she places her child in the electronically monitored box, and there's a bassinet on the inside, and a second alarm goes off. So if the first one was to fail for whatever reason, which it's never the second one would pick up because they're not connected to each other. And once she shuts the door actually locks, and it's a controlled environment on the inside of the baby box. The babies are being pulled on average time of 2 minutes from the time the parent places the child inside the baby box to when a firefighter pulls the baby out. So they're not in there for very long. It does alert 911 dispatch. And, you know, the mother walks away knowing that she did, you know, what she felt was best. I mean, we have to give these parents options. And if this is what they choose, this is a safe option. You know, we should honor that.
According to Safe Haven Baby Box, there are more than 140 infant surrenders using these Safe Haven Baby Boxes installed in 14 states. How could people find a nearby baby box? What is that like?
So the best way to do it is to go just basically Google, you know, Safe Haven Baby Box, Safe Haven Surrender, you know, any of those key phrases. And our website will come up with a map of the closest locations that have baby boxes. We currently have 189 active baby boxes in those states. We're actively every week putting 2 to 3 baby boxes online. And in multiple states, you know, it's not just the 14 that we have now. We're getting ready to launch in Alabama and Texas. Those are two more states that we're adding. And so going to Google really is the best way to find us. Or they can go to our website at shbb.org and find a location near them. And I want to also remind people that even if there's not a baby box around where they are, they can still walk into a fire station or a hospital, or even if there is a baby box in a fire station, they can still walk in the front door and hand the child to a person. We're not taking that option away. We're just adding an option because we would rather have a box and not need it than need a box and not have it.
Monica Kelsey with us, founder and CEO of a nonprofit organization, Safe Haven Baby Boxes, as we talk about a new state law in Wisconsin to allow these boxes. You can join in. Questions and comments are welcome. 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Monica, you bring up the situation in fire stations. Are these baby boxes installed only in places that are staffed 24/7 every day of the year?
Yeah, so they have to be manned 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. And we only put them in police stations, fire stations, and hospitals. And I'll tell you why. The babies that we're getting in our boxes, some of them are coming with placenta still attached, or the cord is cut but not clamped. I mean, these babies are not born in hospitals. And so we want medical personnel on the other side of that box as quickly as possible in that 2 minutes, you know, from that time that baby is placed inside. And so for paramedics at fire stations, and of course, hospitals have ER doctors and nurses, and then police stations are first responder certified, CPR certified as well. We want to make sure that these babies get the appropriate care as quickly as possible. And that's why we do those three locations.
So looking at figures from our State Department of Children and Families showing more than 200 babies have been surrendered statewide since Wisconsin's Safe Haven law took effect back in 2012. Do you think with greater access to baby boxes, would you anticipate the number of surrenders to grow in Wisconsin?
You know, I hope that women are getting help before they get to that point. You know, the baby boxes are a last resort for a reason, and that is just to save the life of a child if a parent won't choose an adoption plan or won't choose a parenting plan, and they don't want to walk into a fire station or a hospital and hand their child to a person. The baby box is there as a last resort, and I hope these women are getting help prior to that. You know, my goal was never to see how many babies I could get in boxes. My goal was to help women find a safe alternative to abandonment. You know, back in 1972, there was no safe haven law. And my birth mother was 17 years old. She was attacked, raped, and left along the side of the road. And she gave birth to me in April of 1973 and then abandoned me 2 hours after I was born. And so I kind of stand on the front lines of a movement as one of these kids that wasn't lovingly and safely and legally placed in a safe haven baby box. And I got to meet my biological mother when I was 37 years old and learn the crisis that she truly was in. And it gave me empathy to work with these women. These women are strong. These women are incredible. These women, you know, they're in a moment of crisis that they just need somebody to have their back. And Safe Haven Baby Boxes is that organization now walking alongside these parents that have their back to make sure that they're keeping their child safe and that their life is going on. Because if they choose something unsafe, if they place their child in a dumpster or a trash can, which we're seeing every 3 days in America, they're going to go to prison for a long time. And this is a way that we can keep them from going to prison. They can have peace knowing that they saved the life of their child. And then this child's going to go on with a set of adoptive parents that's probably been praying for them for a very long time. And so everybody wins in this situation. There is hurt. I'm not going to deny that there is, you know, pain in this process. But at the end of the day, everybody is safe. And that truly is the outcome that we want to achieve.
Monica, some pushback here. Yale University bioethicist Lori Bruce has objected to these boxes, saying that their popularity shows that more people are being forced into childbirth. What do you make of that sentiment?
Well, I'm not here to debate abortion, and I think that's what she's probably going after. You know, these babies are born. These babies are alive, and they're going to go in a dumpster or a trash can. And so if we can just save the life of this child from not going into a dumpster or a trash can, I think we all would agree that that's a better option, placing a baby in a box than placing a baby in a dumpster or a trash can. But, you know, that the pro-life and pro-choice debate is a whole nother issue. That we, you know, I don't think this is the place to talk about that.
Monica, when I look at your map on Safe Haven Baby Boxes, I notice that some states, the span of time to surrender the newborn is 72 hours, like here in Wisconsin, but sometimes it's as many as 30 days. Why does the time span of surrendering a newborn vary so widely across the U.S.?
Well, that's because it's state driven. Mm-hmm. It's not a federal law. We're trying to fix that as well. You know, 30 days across the board is a good number. Most states are 30 days. We have North Dakota that's actually a year. You can surrender up to a year. And we want to make sure it's consistent. That's the problem, is if we're all confused, we're not in a moment of crisis, and we don't know which state is 3 days. We don't know which states are 7 days or 14 days or 30 days. A woman in crisis isn't going to know that either. And so having it consistent across the board is a goal to make sure that nobody's confused. They know exactly what the time frame is. And so, you know, these babies are being surrendered legally and within the time frame that the state requires.
Monica, thank you for joining us.
Thank you guys so much for having me. I truly appreciate it.
Monica Kelsey is founder and CEO of Safe Haven Baby Boxes. It's a nonprofit providing devices to anonymously relinquish custody of babies under 3 days old in Wisconsin. I'm Kate Archer Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network.